promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org.
From Public Radio International, I'm Deborah Amos, and this is America Abroad. This hour on the program, Arrested Development, Shortchanging Foreign Aid.
We will work with our partners, the United Nations, and the Afghan people to pursue a more effective civilian strategy so that the government can take advantage of improved security. This effort must be based on Afghan ministries, governors, and local leaders that combat corruption and deliver for the people. We expect those who are ineffective or corrupt to be held accountable. And we will also focus our assistance in areas such as agriculture that can make an immediate impact in the lives of the Afghan people.
In his latest strategy announcement, President Obama stressed that success will take much more than boots on the ground. Victory requires a civilian force to help Afghans cultivate their land, build government institutions, and deliver public health. And the administration has emphasized that development work is a high priority for its foreign policy beyond conflict zones like Afghanistan and Iraq. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
A personal priority for me as secretary is to elevate and integrate development as a core pillar of American power. We advance our security, our prosperity, and our values by improving the material conditions of people's lives around the world.
The examples that Americans know about obviously would be Afghanistan, problems in Somalia.
Nancy Birdsall, president of the Center for Global Development.
But there's also drug trafficking, avian flu. A lot of the problems that cross borders need to be dealt with in part by building up stronger states elsewhere. We also want to deal with it because in general, it makes a tremendous difference for us when more people enter the middle class.
But over the last two decades, whether for strategic or humanitarian reasons, U.S. foreign assistance has faltered. And that's because, by all accounts, the government's leading development agency is broken and badly in need of repair. Back in its heyday in the 60s and 70s, the U.S. Agency for International Development had tens of thousands of people with expertise in farming, engineering, or governance, and they were spread across the globe, working on poverty reduction, infrastructure development, and public health. But two decades ago, the agency began to lose steam and staff.
In 1980, there were 4,000 AID officers.
Andrew Natsios headed the agency from 2001 to 2005.
When I arrived back in AID, there was something like 1,900 left. There was a huge purge during the Clinton administration, the mid-1990s, and the Republicans supported it. Both parties are to blame for this. But the damage was that all the senior officers with years of experience who know how to do this stuff were forced into early retirement. And it's affected the whole agency.
The crippling staff cuts have turned America's leading voice on foreign aid and global development into little more than a grant-making institution. Today, there are just 6 engineers and 16 agricultural specialists at USAID. And now, the agency increasingly has to pay others who have the manpower to carry out its mission. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
We have devoted a smaller percentage of our government budget to development than almost any other advanced country. And too little of what we have spent has contributed to genuine and lasting progress. Too much of the money has never reached its intended target, but stayed here in America to pay salaries or fund overhead in contracts.
This hour, we explore some of the problems with U.S. foreign aid, problems that the Obama administration has been slow to address. It took almost a year to appoint a new head for USAID, and the vast majority of top political positions in the agency remain unfilled. In this program, we'll examine the history of U.S. foreign aid from its beginnings in the Marshall Plan through its present state of disarray. And we'll visit Ethiopia, home to one of the largest USAID missions in the world. We begin in Afghanistan. President Obama has ordered a civilian surge in the country, and that's because, more often than not, soldiers are leading the development mission. America Abroad's Sean Carberry traveled to Afghanistan to explore the challenges of doing development work in a war zone.
I know. Come here. My name is Captain Bob Klein. I'm with the 1st and 19th Agribusiness Development Team. I'm an animal husbandry subject matter expert. I am the head goat herder, I guess that would be the proper title. We're in Host Province, Afghanistan, and currently we're at Fob Salerno. And this is our experimental farm on Fob Salerno for the Agribusiness Development Team.
Captain Klein isn't exactly the soldier you see on recruiting posters. The accountant and prosecutor from Heltonville, Indiana, carries around pictures of his family farm back home. He says the snapshots of his ducks and donkeys help him to connect with the Afghan farmers he meets on his missions with the Agribusiness Development Team, or ADT. And when he's not outside the wire, he's tending to his projects on the experimental farm. It's an old 14-acre orchard in the middle of Forward Operating Base Salerno, one of the larger bases in the Dust Bowl of southeastern Afghanistan.
And what we see here is the goats that we're using to test various animal husbandry techniques. What we're doing is we're taking known animal husbandry techniques that are used in other parts of the world, and primarily in the United States too, and seeing how animals respond to it in this environment.
The view in Washington is that development is key to winning in Afghanistan. Since 85% of Afghanistan's economy is based on agriculture, the U.S. is sowing seeds to help grow crops and security. And as more troops continue to roll into Afghanistan, some, like Captain Klein, are taking on some rather unconventional assignments, like herding goats.
The very first thing I did with them was I wormed them. And in a week's time after worming them, they, on average for the seven of them, they increased 13% body weight.
Captain Klein estimates that all of the goats in Afghanistan have worms. He's trying to teach government officials, professors, and tribal elders that using 25 cents worth of worming medicine can increase the value of a goat by $5 or more.
Us giving them things, just buying $100,000 items or buildings or stuff, that's not building people. The whole solution, at least in Bob Klein's view, not necessarily anybody else's, is teach people skills. We're going to train government officials, professors, and others in those positions, and then they take that knowledge and they pass it on.
Agribusiness development teams are National Guard units from farming states like Tennessee, Kentucky, and in Captain Klein's case, Indiana. The 1st of the 19th consists of about 35 troops to handle security when the team leaves the base, and 16 technical experts in subjects like hydrology, animal husbandry, and rangeland management. And ADTs sprouted up in the last year and a half as civilian development agencies have struggled to address the perceived needs on the ground. And while they're proud of the work they're doing to improve crop production and the health of livestock, members of the ADT will be the first to tell you that men and women in camouflage doing development work is not the ideal.
We're in a very non-permissive environment where, as a soldier carrying a rifle and pistol and body armor and everything else I have at my disposal, it's much safer for me to go than NGOs. And they're much better suited, really, than the military is at this, but by necessity, you got to do some development. You know, if people are starving, they're more willing to do things that are illegal and can hurt other people. So that's where the development piece comes into play, at least for me.
While non-governmental organizations, NGOs, that work in the country agree that development is essential to build security and stability over the long run, they uniformly oppose the militarization of development work.
What we're really concerned about is the short-term view and the subverting of aid to political aims, not basing it on actual needs, but on some perceived notion of what will win loyalty or stabilize things in the short term.
Ashley Jackson is a researcher for Oxfam, one of a number of NGOs working in Afghanistan. Over tea in a heavily secured garden cafe, a bit of an oasis in Kabul, she listed a number of concerns about the use of development projects to win hearts and minds under counterinsurgency strategy.
When it's subverted to political objectives, especially in a conflict situation, you endanger all NGOs working there, but you know, not only that, but the Afghans you're trying to help.
As the security situation deteriorated over the last couple of years, attacks on aid workers increased. According to the Afghan NGO Safety Office, there were about 100 security incidents in 2006 and 170 in 2008. That's despite increased security measures adopted by NGOs and aid groups in the country.
The old mantra within humanitarian aid is that there's never security without development, and there's no true development without proper security. And it's the same here.
Bob Kitchen is the country director for the International Rescue Committee. It's an NGO that's been working in Afghanistan for 25 years on various humanitarian and development projects. The IRC has been another vocal critic of the way the U.S. military has taken on more development tasks.
I think the best course of action would be for the military that is in country to focus on what they are trained in and what they do best, which is developing the security forces of Afghanistan and leaving the civilian development programs to civilians, whether that's their government counterparts, whether it's contractors, or whether it's NGOs who have years and decades of experience in country. But having military engaged in projects with community dynamics that are not fully understood is it's complicating things and making matters worse in many cases.
If I could pick up and go home tomorrow, I would. I'd leave it to the NGOs and the civilian agencies. The security situation, the insurgency does not allow an environment for that to take place.
Lieutenant Colonel Carlos Holcomb is the commander of the provincial reconstruction team based in Paktia province.
So you're left with the choice of using the military to get some of that development done while the insurgency is being quelled. That's the reality of it.
Sitting next to Colonel Holcomb in his office at Forward Operating Base Gardez is John Kugler. He's the U.S. Agency for International Development, or AID, representative on the Provincial Reconstruction Team, or PRT in military speak. PRTs contain large numbers of security forces, army engineers, and civil affairs troops, and one State Department and USAID representative per team. And in places where security is rough, they're the only vehicle for USAID to get into the field.
When I push open a project, I'm showing up with, you know, with like 30 guys in camouflage. So in that's an obstacle, you know, because there are a lot of NGOs. And then the people that the NGOs are helping, they don't want that kind of attention drawn to them. I can appreciate that.
Currently, there are close to 70,000 troops on the ground and thousands more now on the way. In contrast, John Kugler is one of about 300 USAID personnel in Afghanistan. And 70% of them are walled up in the secure compound in Kabul and rarely interact with development projects on the ground. Out in the provinces, people like John are few and far between. And both civilians and military personnel I spoke with said they wish there were more civilians out in the field.
There aren't enough NGOs here. There's not enough people here to do it. Aid doesn't have enough people here to do it. State doesn't have enough people here to do it. That's not a secret. So the only people who are left are military.
That's another symptom of a long-running condition, the gutting of USAID since the Vietnam era.
I'm Bill Frey, the USAID mission director in Afghanistan. In the 60s and 70s here, USAID had a very large staff. There were some 300 Americans on the ground at that point in time. USAID at that point in time was probably 15,000 persons strong. Today we have approximately 1,000 foreign services officers working in the field. And that's reflected in this mission, although this is the largest mission in the world in terms of both people as well as funding. It's not what the aid structure was in the 60s and the 70s, clearly here or anywhere else in the world.
And Director Frey says that USAID is trying to build its presence and programs in the country. The agency has spent $8 billion since 2002, though the majority has gone through U.S. rather than Afghan contractors. That's been one of the persistent criticisms of USAID's work, that it's funded American contractors who then subcontract the work out, to the point that a small percentage of the money is actually hitting the ground. USAID hopes to change that through
more Afghanization of our programs, more engagement with Afghans, and focus on programs that will create jobs in this country. That's why the agricultural sector is so important. Lastly, decentralizing both our staff and our programs much more to the provincial and district levels, and assisting in this effort, connecting the government of Afghanistan with its people so that they're perceived as the primary deliverer of services.
And do you have the staff that you need to do that?
We need more staff here. We need technical experts in the agricultural sector, in the governance sector, justice sector. We are engaging with Washington on a daily basis in terms of bringing out the requisite senior staff that we need in this country to make a difference.
USAID hopes to put another 100 people on the ground, but you can't just pluck people off the streets and send them into the field. It takes time to train people, and due to the gutting of USAID in the 80s and 90s, there's not a deep bench of agricultural and governance experts to draw from. USAID is also wrestling with an ideological shift. The military, Congress, and the American people are interested in quick-impact projects that show immediate results. USAID, on the other hand, has historically looked at building capacity in institutions, work that can take years, even decades. John Kugler.
You know, I actually had the advantage of working with four state last year, and so I've sort of seen the same problem from two opposite sides of the coin. There was a military presentation going on about we need aid to do X, Y, and Z over the next 6 to 12 to 18 months. Aid responded, well, you know, we don't operate in terms of that. We're going to be operating 5, 10 years maybe. We're thinking 25 years. And the guy looked, you know, sort of quieted for a second and said, well, if you think in 15-year increments, there's not going to be anything here in 15 years.
Hence the growing sense of urgency among the military and the increasing pressure on USAID to think short term.
Aid is actually getting to the point now where in some respects it's splitting itself in half. There are offices that are forming within aid. They're supposed to be the quick reaction force. Here's your funding. Here's your expertise. Go do the quick impact stuff. And then the other half of the office will be the traditionalists. And I think that's probably a good way to do it. You know, you just don't mix your missions.
But there's still an elephant in the room.
The problem has been that the political leadership and sometimes the Pentagon will say, the diplomatic leadership, we need to spend more money on X, when the minister running the department has no interest in reform, no interest in delivering public services. They see the aid program as a way of enriching and supporting their patronage networks, the people who rely on them for power and money. If you put money through ministries run in that way, you will have failures.
Andrew Natsios was head of USAID from 2001 to 2005.
If they want to put more money into ministries that are critically important to the counterinsurgency, then the U.S. government needs to go in and see President Karzai and say, if you want us to win this, to work with you to defeat the insurgency, we need competent people in the following ministries. We have not done that.
And largely what the U.S. has done is focus on initiatives where there are measurable outcomes, number of schools built or miles of road paved.
The problem is the outcomes they're measuring are things that could be measured easily. How many children are being immunized? What's happening is we're hiring NGOs, contractors, the UN, to immunize children, not people in the ministries of health or in private health care delivery systems in the country. We're transplanting international institutions into countries run by outsiders, and we're calling that development.
But until the civilian surge ramps up in full force and there are enough development experts on the ground, then the military and people like Captain Klein are going to continue to look for ways to win the war, even if that's one goat at a time.
You know, the military is a force. I mean, and you give it a mission, and it does the mission. And if it doesn't have what it needs to do that mission, it figures out a way to do that mission.
I'm Sean Carberry for America Abroad.
That is goat herding 101.
I'm Deborah Amos for America Abroad. Joining us to talk about the challenges and the way forward for U.S. foreign aid is Congressman Howard Berman, a senior Democrat who heads the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He introduced legislation calling for reform and a comprehensive foreign aid strategy. He joins us from his office on the Hill.
It is true that since 9/11, the military has gotten more and more involved, and it's now become part of a military doctrine. Is it then the military's role to do most of this humanitarian and developmental aid?
I don't think so. I think we have an agency and people who have been trained and have a background in the most effective kind of development assistance. Our military is here to fight and train others to fight. And I think it's important that we get what we need from each of these areas of our federal government.
But they have been doing most of the heavy lifting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Do you think that's a problem?
I do, because I think it undercuts the effectiveness of the program. The reason they have been doing it is not because they want to do it. The reason they've been doing it is because we have allowed the capacity of our Development Assistance Agency, the USAID, to be weakened terribly. We have allowed the different development assistance programs to be proliferated among many different agencies. So since Congress helped to allow this situation to happen, I think we have the obligation to try and reform that program so that the people who are most effective at developing the development assistance have the resources and the position to implement those programs.
Congressman, you have spoken eloquently about and you've pushed for foreign American assistance. Most Americans don't agree with you. Why do you think it's so important?
Actually, I would disagree. I think most Americans support the fundamental humanitarian goals of foreign assistance if they have confidence it's being well spent. But the humanitarian goals are only one part of, I think, our compelling national interest in promoting foreign assistance. As we've learned from our actions in Iraq and Afghanistan and even in Pakistan, foreign assistance is an essential component of an effective counterinsurgency strategy. There are clear national security implications in a foreign assistance program. We're not going to be successful in these counterinsurgency efforts if we don't help the people in those countries, if we don't get them on our side of this struggle.
Congressman Howard Berman, senior Democrat who heads the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Congressman, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we'll explore the history of U.S. foreign assistance from the Marshall Plan to the creation of USAID in 1961 and its decline after the Cold War. I'm Deborah Amos, and you're listening to Arrested Development, Shortchanging Foreign Aid on America Abroad. I'm Deborah Amos, and you're listening to Arrested Development on America Abroad. This hour, we're exploring the past and present state of U.S. foreign assistance.
Our policy is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos.
In the summer of 1947,
Secretary of State George Marshall announced America's plan to assist in European recovery after the Second World War. The goals of U.S. foreign assistance haven't changed much in the more than six decades since the Marshall Plan. National security, economic growth, and humanitarian relief are at the heart of U.S. assistance abroad. Though the goals have been constant, the effectiveness of international aid has not. As we've discussed earlier in the program, the Agency for International Development lacks direction and significant on-the-ground capacity. It's largely become a contracting agency and is a shell of its former self. It hardly resembles the grand campaign of foreign aid marshaled by the U.S. Secretary of State after World War II.
In the German capital, economic progress is marked as the Berlin Industrial Fair is opened by former ECA chief Paul Hoffman. The exhibit shows the first products of a developing free enterprise system stimulated by the Marshall Plan.
The ultimate goal for the Truman administration in the Marshall Plan was to get Europe running again commercially, industrially.
Louis Picard is a professor of international development at the University of Pittsburgh.
Strategically, they were beginning to see the importance of the soft side of the Cold War, that this was not just weapons and potential military conflict, but of course it was the hearts and minds of the peoples of Europe which were of concern, since there was a fear that communism would move west.
In France, the city of Caen, like much of Europe, almost completely destroyed during the war, is slowly but surely rising again due to Marshall Plan aid. Caen, the center of bitter fighting in the Allied invasion of Normandy, is being helped by ECA funds. Its people have lived in ruins through five harsh winters, but are now moving into the dozens of new buildings which the French have constructed with American help. Europe is again reaching an independent status, and that's good news.
The Truman administration quickly sought to apply the successful lessons of the Marshall Plan around the globe. Foreign assistance was an important part of President Truman's inaugural address in 1949.
Greater production is the key to prosperity and peace. And the key to greater production is a wider and more vigorous application of modern scientific and technical knowledge. Only by helping the least fortunate of his members to help themselves can the human family achieve the decent, satisfying life that is the right of all people.
There was an element of humanitarianism. There was also a concern to expand trade. And then finally, of course, the Cold War was increasingly going to be a part of the international relations of what we would later call the Third World or the developing world.
As the Cold War deepened, Americans on both sides of the aisle rallied around the idea of foreign assistance.
During the Eisenhower administration and then afterwards, you really had two themes in U.S. foreign aid, a very strong security theme and a very strong development theme.
Carol Lancaster is the dean of Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service.
And those were very interesting politically because it gave the opportunity for the administration and for managers in Congress to create a right-left coalition that got aid through the Congress. The left was more interested in development, although many were also Cold Warriors at the time. The right wasn't so interested in development, but was interested in U.S. security. And that has continued until today. And we have had that marriage. It's been an uneasy marriage. It's been a contentious marriage. But it's been a marriage, nonetheless, that has worked for us.
But the marriage of America's military and humanitarian goals during the Cold War gave birth to resentment in the developing world. That theme was captured in the 1958 best-selling book, The Ugly American. 5 years later, the book became a hit film, starring Marlon Brando as the U.S. ambassador to the fictional country of Sarkhan. In the film, Brando's character is unable to persuade Sarkhan's national leader, de Jong, that the American infrastructure project, Freedom Road, is being built for the Sarkhanese people.
Now, de Jong, if this doesn't begin to sink in pretty soon, this country, Sarkhan, is going to end up just the way Cuba did.
Cuba? Cuba is what you made it. You helped Batista. Against the people. You always make dictators strong. Then wonder why you are not loved. This is Sarkhan. Not the United States. We don't get down our knees to the stars and stripes here.
You cheap, twisted ingrate. I am damn proud of the Stars and Stripes, and they've been pretty good to you. Who do you think's been buying your groceries for the past 7 years? I'm not talking about the United States government. I'm talking about the American people. From Boise, Idaho, and Moline, Illinois. People that have contributed millions of dollars out of their own pockets.
Now, you listen. You wouldn't care about us if the Cold War didn't exist. Millions of us know it.
Again, Louis Picard.
Kennedy is said to have read The Ugly American and understood the message that was there. And there was an attempt to separate, at least for public opinion purposes, civilian, humanitarian, and development assistance from military assistance.
To those people in the huts and villages of half the globe, struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves. For whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right.
When President John F. Kennedy took office, he emphasized the moral imperative to provide foreign assistance in his 1961 inaugural address.
If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich.
JFK's idealism spurred several government initiatives to help those struggling to break the bonds of mass misery. The Alliance for Progress in Latin America and the Peace Corps accompanied a wholesale reorganization of American foreign assistance efforts. The result of that reorganization was a new agency to oversee the provision of international assistance, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. But Kennedy's idealism didn't mean Cold War concerns had melted away. His new program also served important strategic interests. Carol Lancaster.
And, you know, some ways his pitch for what became USAID and many of the programs we are familiar with today was primarily a Cold War pitch. We have to mobilize our resources to bring about beneficial economic and social change in poor countries in order to keep them from giving way to the temptation of communism.
For USAID, it was trial by fire. As America sunk deeper into the jungles of Vietnam, President Lyndon Johnson viewed development assistance as an essential part of American strategy in Indochina. In the spring of 1965, Johnson devoted special attention to the thousands of USAID workers that had descended on Vietnam.
It takes men. Men must take the seed to the farmer. Men must teach the use of fertilizer. Men must help in harvest. Men must build the schools, and men must instruct the students. And men must carry medicine into the jungle and treat the sick and shelter the homeless. And men, brave, tireless, filled with love for their fellows, are doing this today. They're doing it through the long, hot, danger-filled Vietnamese days and the sultry nights.
Those men were USAID workers. They partnered with the U.S. military to work on agricultural, health, and infrastructure projects throughout Vietnam.
Fighting communist guerrillas in South Vietnam continues a slow grind. Yet, despite the handicap of the terrain and the political erosion in Saigon, the soldiers keep fighting on.
Again, Carol Lancaster.
The problem, of course, was that you had a war going on. It's very difficult to do long-term development in the middle of a war, and you had a relentless, powerful foe in the north, and disciplined.
U.S. foreign aid fared better elsewhere. American technical assistance, supplies, and loans contributed to the Green Revolution, the series of agricultural advancements that helped feed millions throughout Asia. But by the mid-1970s, defeat in Vietnam combined with deepening economic malaise prompted America to look inwards.
You know, this was a period when we were looking at our own cities and our own rural areas and saying, well, you know, what about Appalachia? What about East St. Louis?
Louis Picard.
So a lot of that pushback was related to crisis at home and a kind of sense that the world was no longer as friendly as it was before.
By the 1980s,
any friendly feelings Congress had toward the U.S. foreign assistance budget was fading. Less money for USAID meant less personnel and capacity.
By the 80s, they are shifting away from hands-on work. And much of what AID does, and I think to the frustration of many working there, very talented people, is that they are increasingly, or have been for the last 25 years or so, increasingly contract managers.
As the Cold War came to a close, budget cuts continued to squeeze USAID. Again, Carol Lancaster.
Another thing that happened to AID in the last 10 or 15 years was a compression in its numbers, where Congress said, you have to do more with less. You have to do more with less. And so at some point, you're in a death spiral when it comes to hiring.
USAID did survive the bureaucratic contraction, but the organization continued to shrink. To explore how these recent changes have affected the delivery of U.S. foreign assistance on the ground, America Abroad's Matt Ozog traveled to Ethiopia. His report is coming up after the break. I'm Deborah Amos, and you're listening to Arrested Development, Shortchanging Foreign Aid on America Abroad.
Support for America Abroad is provided by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, the Star Foundation, the Henry Luce Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation, the Stewart Family Foundation, and from the American Interest, a magazine devoted to illuminating America's global role. Support for America Abroad also comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Deborah Amos, and you're listening to Arrested Development on America Abroad. 25 years ago this month, if you turned on a radio anywhere in America, you were likely to hear this. A number one hit from the rock celebrity project Band-Aid. The song raised public awareness of the famine in East Africa that was on its way to taking the lives of a million Ethiopians. In the quarter century since Bob Geldof, Sting, Bono, and others pleaded, "Feed the world," that task has proven anything but simple. Despite one of the largest USAID missions in the world and over a half billion development dollars committed annually, 13 million Ethiopians are at risk of starvation this year, the same as in 1984. With both significant need and a large American footprint, Ethiopia is a case study in some of the challenges facing U.S. development assistance around the world. America Abroad's Matt Ozog reports.
Addis Ababa's Mercado is the biggest open-air market in all of Africa. It's a massive swarm of donkeys, trucks, buses, and people buying and selling what feels like literally anything you can imagine, from chewing gum to new cars, suits tailored, keys cut, and teeth pulled. Behind a mosque, there's even an old man braiding strands of scrap cloth to sell as twine. This country made international headlines some 25 years ago, for the famine that killed 1 million people. But as this grain market in the corner of the Mercado shows, parts of Ethiopia are rich breadbaskets, growing corn, sorghum, chickpeas, and that staple of the Ethiopian diet, teff. But constant droughts, poor irrigation, and distribution challenges all mean that many here live on the brink of starvation. Although everyone agrees that there's a need to modernize Ethiopia's farms, development dollars are heavily tilted towards emergency food over agricultural development.
My name is Mark Nosbach, and I'm the current acting director for Save the Children USA in Ethiopia. $560 million is provided in food aid, that's food commodities, to Ethiopia. In contrast, only about $4.6 million is actually invested for agricultural development. So it's a staggering gap.
While the size of that staggering gap varies from year to year, an even greater challenge for USAID is that despite the scale of the problems here, staffing has shrunk to historic lows. AID Mission Director Tom Stahl.
It got down to close to about only 1,000 to administer the entire foreign aid program for the U.S. government, for the world. That's a pretty small number, and so I think it definitely needs to grow. There's a certain number of technical experts that it's good to have. Okay, if you're doing a livestock program, it's good to have somebody who knows something about livestock. And so there's a few key technical experts that I think would be important to have on our staff.
Instead, that technical expertise is often farmed out. FinTrack is one medium-scale contractor for the agency. With no other funder, USAID is their business plan. FinTrack has one project outside of the city of Nazareth that's encouraging farmers to organize into co-ops and grow new crops, like passion fruit. On the drive to Nazareth, Tamana, a trained agronomist on the project, says not only is passion fruit a new crop to these farmers, but the drip irrigation scheme, using lengths of perforated watering tape, is both technologically and culturally foreign.
The project was planned really like it would be implemented in Europe.
When you say it was designed as if it were for Europe, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a good thing it's planned in the first place, but it's also not good that the African, and particularly the Ethiopian, situation is not taken into consideration.
Irrigation, if it's practiced here, often means diverting streams and flooding troughs between crops, a less efficient, if more understood, method. While specialists like FinTrack have significant skills and hire scores of local staffers, many Ethiopians feel that the use of contractors means fewer dollars for ordinary Ethiopians. Shimite Gaza is an Ethiopian doctoral student in development studies.
I doubt most of the money that's coming from the international organizations is spent for structural things, okay? Only some amount of money is reached at the local level. Most of the money is probably spent in the process. Maybe that is a problem.
But the problem for AID is that how the cash gets spent is increasingly out of their hands.
I'm Kevin Smith. I'm the supervisory program officer here at USAID Ethiopia. We can lobby Washington all we want as for the resources we need and for what types of things, but ultimately Washington sends us a budget. You're going to get so much money for economic growth, so much money for agriculture, so much money for health, so much money for education. The more we can control those resources, the more say we have over those resources, the better.
How much of the budget do you have local flexibility and control over versus how much is predetermined?
Quite a bit is predetermined. I think last year we might have gotten around 75% of our budget, like earmarked, as they call it. The vast majority of it, maybe there's a little over $100 million left for like what we'd consider like traditional development. So when you add all that up, it can kind of earmark us quite a bit.
With a budget that's earmarked up and controlled by the State Department, AID has less and less authority over the development strategy here. That means they can't easily shift funds towards long-term development solutions, like solving the chronic cycle of food insecurity and encouraging growth in the private sector. USAID Mission Director Tom Stahl.
Countries that are economically developed tend to be more stable. So for a variety of reasons, the small percentage that we put into the U.S. government budget, which, by the way, is only about a half of 1%, goes to international development. I think it's a great investment for the U.S., not just for the countries we're helping.
Of that sliver of the U.S. budget devoted to foreign assistance, USAID dedicates a smaller sliver of the development pie to capacity building in the private sector. One business that sees a taste is Walia Leather.
My family, starting from my grandparents, they started from scratch, from nothing. And then they start to trade, you know, rawhides. And step by step, you know, here we are today.
Yared is the third-generation manager of Walia Leather, who also receives support from AID via the contractor Fintrac.
There are two very important things when we get into this business. The first one is the market, and the second one is the expertise. Unless you have those two, you know what I mean, you won't be doing anything and you won't be achieving anything, honestly speaking. So USAID has been very active in these two important things. First of all, there has been a marked difference of employee habits. That's one of the most important things to make them a lot more efficient. When we start producing, they were producing like 200 per day. And you may not believe this, but on the third day, they were producing 400 per day. So it's a direct kind of assistance, and we were, you know, seeing the outcome in just 2-3 days.
Such transformative changes are not the norm for development work. Instead, what a generation of foreign aid has shown is that emergency assistance can prevent the kind of mass famine that catalyzed world attention in 1984. But unless more resources are dedicated to lifting this nation out of poverty and transforming their markets, the crisis of regular food shortages is destined to continue.
Now USAID has introduced a lot of private sector support, which is doing some good things. But, you know, these are small initiatives, you know.
Maria Strinsos runs REST, a relief society for Tigray in northern Ethiopia. It's the largest local NGO in the country, and over half their budget comes from USAID.
Why don't you push for sustainable solutions, you know, instead of food aid or another emergency has happened, so you're going to go to some part of the country where there is an emergency and you do an emergency stop, you know, another CNN moment. That's not development. But of course, it doesn't always rebalance that way, because at the end of the day, there's always more of a moral imperative to save lives than the hard slog and the complex slog of actually doing long-term sustainable development. But as I said, there's all these bright lights at USAID. You know, they do all these wonderful things too, but then they don't bring them to scale.
Strinso says bringing things to scale and enhancing the effectiveness of development in Ethiopia is the promise on which the Obama administration came into power.
I'll tell a story of a young boy in Tigray. I don't know, he must be about 12. And he was wearing an Obama T-shirt. And it had in English, "Yes, we can," but it also had in Tigrinya, "Yes, we can." And this little boy, I mean, this is in the back of nowhere, you know? That little boy of 12 years of age, he knew where that assistance in his village came from. And USAID and the US government is poised in a perfect position right now to actually make a difference. All I would ask is that USAID capitalizes on the opportunities, the space that's there available. We need to see more of that in action.
For America Abroad, I'm Matt Ozug.
I'm Deborah Amos. As we just heard, Ethiopia is a good case study for the challenges facing U.S. foreign assistance. This Horn of Africa nation hosts one of USAID's largest missions, but for some Ethiopians, starvation remains an all-too-familiar threat despite the steady flow of U.S. development dollars. America Abroad spoke with former USAID Administrator Andrew Natsios about America's fractured foreign aid system.
In Ethiopia, for example, only 1.5% of the aid program in Ethiopia goes for agriculture, even though 85% of the people are farmers or herders, in a country that has famines every few years. We're spending money on food aid to feed people, but not money on agriculture development so that we can increase agricultural production, which is what the Ethiopian government wants and the Ethiopian people want.
Natsios and other former USAID heads say the U.S. government is at its best in an emergency, delivering food during a famine, antiretroviral drugs to those infected with HIV, and supplies after an earthquake. But when it comes to agricultural development and building strong government institutions, America hasn't done nearly as well.
It's called the sustainability question. Is the program sustainable once aid stops? And many of the people demanding that AID provide immediate, quantifiable, measurable results don't get that by demanding that, they are compromising the sustainability of these programs. Because what we're quantifying is how many schools we built, how many teachers we've trained, instead of whether the Ministry of Education can run the schools after we leave, which is the real central question here.
But the what's and how's of aid are decided on Capitol Hill rather than on the ground in places like Ethiopia and Afghanistan, says Natsios.
The problem is they're earmarking funds for specific sectors, and then they micromanage how the programs run. The best development programs are ones that are tailored to the country in which they're being run. Heads of state will call up the AID mission director and say, look, I've got a scandal in this ministry. I need technical help to how to prosecute these people, how to develop the evidence. You need democracy and governance money to do that. Well, there's no discretionary democracy and money, government's money left to do that. So the aid mission director has to say, I can't help you because there's no money to do that.
But it's going to take much more than flexible money and a larger budget. The government needs to rethink and remake its approach to foreign aid, says Nancy Birdsall, who heads the Center for Global Development.
It's not clear to me that we know yet how to spend effectively all the resources that are being spent in the developing world through some sort of foreign aid program. To be honest, I think the first step has to be to find ways to make the agency more effective before there's more resources.
You've been listening to Arrested Development, Shortchanging Foreign Aid. For photo galleries and an interactive map of USAID projects in Afghanistan and Ethiopia, visit us on the web at americaabroad.org. Aaron Lobel is our executive producer. Our program was produced by Monica Bushman, Sean Carberry, Matt Ozog, Monica Villavicencio, and Chris Williams. Our director of broadcasting and station relations is Steve Martin. Four-piece suit composed our theme music. I'm Deborah Amos, and this is America Abroad from Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is Lisa Mullins. Events that affect your life the most often take place far from home. In financial markets, from London to Hong Kong, in war zones halfway around the globe, and in political negotiations that can change the course of history. That's why PRI's The World brings you a global view of the day's events. Join us on PRI's The World.
Monday through Friday afternoons at 3.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers versatile catering options for breakfast meetings, working lunches, or afternoon receptions. Services include a wide selection of food and beverages suited to any budget. More information is available online or at 244-2233.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.